Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin, it looks like our new president is going to have some problems over in the Middle East. The Israelis decided to finally go in and swat down Hamas, who's been throwing rockets their way for how long now, Jim?
Since 2002. Everybody takes credit for the invention of the homemade rocket, but apparently it was Hamas. Hamas actually started the suicide bombing back in the 90s, about 10 years before. So Hamas has been in the front, so to speak, with all this violence against Israel. Again, the main problem, which no one, especially Obama, should lose sight of, is Israel is a democracy. And if somebody is killing your citizens, I mean, anybody on the internet can go look at the English language versions of the Israeli media. The media and the people get very upset, and they basically want action. I mean, you saw what happened in the United States, you know, after 9/11. Hezbollah knows this. They try and keep the body count low, and they have, you know, not because they're trying real hard, simply because they haven't got the weapons. But Israelis are aware that all of the Palestinian media for more than 10 years, actually going on 20 years, has been of the most virulent, kill the Jews, destroy Israel. So short term, they're throwing a few rockets over. Long term, they want to kill everybody. So what's a politician going to do when he looks at the polls and they're saying, do something, do something, do something, do something? And of course, elections are coming up in Israel, and the current incumbent, Olmert, is in big trouble, as is his party. And that's the way it works. And any democratically elected, you know, government can understand that. And they will privately, but, you know, publicly in Europe, it's become fashionable to say the Israelis are beasts and monsters and geez, lay off the poor Palestinians. But you know, the Palestinians are their own worst enemy.
Yeah, I mean, that's been true since the very beginning of the conflict back in the 20s and 30s.
Well, not only that, this time, as we did a piece, which is still very popular on the page, about the Hamas stepping on the wrong toes. I mean, the big problem with Hamas this time around is they're a puppet, so to speak. They're a protege of Iran. And there's a growing war going on between Sunni Islam and Shia Islam, represented, of course, and championed by Iran. That is all over the Arab media. Again, we have the internet now. You don't have to take the pundit's word for it. You just mouse on over to the English language. And remember, especially in the Arabic media, the English language stuff tends to be toned down a lot. So if you could understand Arabic, or if you know someone who does, you know, go and appreciate the real high-powered stuff. You know, it's like Chinese food. A non-Chinese goes in, you get the watered-down stuff. If you speak Chinese or you're Chinese, you go in there, you can get the stuff that really, you know, blow your cheeks out. They are getting hotter and hotter about Iranian intentions in the Persian Gulf. And this is becoming a big issue in the Arab world. And so a lot, and this has come out in the mass media, a lot of Arab countries, in fact, some of them have been very upfront about it. They're not so much backing Israel as they're criticizing Hamas. And they're not criticizing Hamas so much because they're trying to kill Jews, but because they're doing it at the behest of Hamas, who is seen as an enemy of the Arabs. So Hamas has really picked too many fights at the same time. And the question really comes, and nobody wants to talk about this, at least in the mainstream media. It's really whether or not Israel can obliterate Hamas. That's what they're in there for. They got lists of people. They're looking for individuals. That's why you got people on the ground in there. They're not just looking for the rockets, because the rockets can be replaced. But the key people in the Hamas, you know, hierarchy cannot be replaced, especially the ones who are closest to Iran, and there are factions in Hamas, and some of them are more pro-Iran than others. So there's a lot going on in this Gaza war, which is not being reported, and it's not being reported deliberately because the Israelis have put a clamp down on the on reporters going into the combat zone. And the even the reporters going in from the Arab side through Egypt tend to be pro-Sunni.
Right.
Not too many Iranian reporters in there. So there are things happening which are completely off the radar at the moment, but they'll eventually emerge.
Now, you wrote about just how incredible the intelligence has been on this operation, that it got to the level of they were actually calling up the homes and telling people to clear out before the bombs came in where they had been storing munitions and like that.
Yeah, considering that they dropped over 1,000 smart bombs and missiles so far, and by anybody's admission, there's only been about 300 civilians killed. They've done a remarkable job, but at the same time, Hamas has never made a secret about its intention to use human, you know, shields, civilians as human shields as much as possible. And they even have a whole philosophy about it. They call it involuntary martyrdom. You know, the civilians often don't have a choice. And again, a lot of stories, accounts of this will come out after it's all over. But even before it really got rolling, in the early days, there were some Western reporters or some, you know, video footage got out of people and Palestinians in Gaza basically blaming Hamas. Because basically it is Hamas's warlike attitude which has brought on all the violence, and it's been going on for over 10 years now, and people are getting tired of it, even the Palestinians. So this is a war where basically Hamas is fighting not just the Israelis, but, you know, a lot of people who in the past, you know, would be on their side. We're not going to know until suddenly the dust settles and it's all over, when the Israelis, have destroyed Hamas to the extent that they think it won't come back up. Because phase two of the destruction of Hamas is slipping, you know, Fatah in there. Now, Fatah leadership is out there screaming at Israel, oh my God. But the way that works is Israel asked, as a humanitarian gesture, would Fatah send some people into Gaza to help, you know, restore order and give aid to the suffering civilians. And, you know, what politician can resist an offer like that? So Fatah will march in, you know, again yelling and screaming at the Israelis, but they'll take over because that's what they want. I mean, so that's what's really going on.
Right.
And that's really what the end game is. And the only way Hamas is going to win is if they can pile up enough dead civilians to somehow force Europeans or, say, the Russians, as in the past, to threaten armed intervention, which is not going to happen this time around. So basically the Israelis are willing, apparently, to take an enormous amount of ill will. But then again, they've got so much already, but there's a little more hurt, in order to go in there and root out Hamas. So it's really a battle, it's a death match between the Israelis and Hamas. Nobody will say it, but that's what it's all about, because why else would the Israelis go to this much trouble and, you know, risk this many Israeli lives?
Right. Now, Austin, what is your perspective on this? One of the things I'm interested in is there was a proposal to put an international police force in after this is all over to try to keep the rockets from going out. But how realistic is that even?
Have international police forces, international monitoring forces worked in the between Israel and Lebanon, you know, UNIFIL? No, it didn't work. The International Monitoring Force prior to 1967 didn't work. I will say the U.S.-led monitoring force between Egypt and Israel in Sinai has helped, but it's really because that Egypt and Israel, even though some folks call it a cold peace, they've actually pursued a peace process because the
but I think everybody understands that if push came to shove, the Americans wouldn't move.
Oh yeah. You know, the Americans would move from a lot of levels, and it's it wouldn't be to the benefit of the Egyptian government, Egyptian people, Israeli government, Israeli people. The American force is not there to fight. It's a political chip. But the reason that I brought that up is because it is, if somebody was going to say, hey, Bay, you just said these international monitoring forces didn't work. Well, how about that one? Okay, we've also seen that it was a monitoring force in Gaza. Extremely mixed results. Recall that Syria and Israel had a interesting little air war prior to the invasion of Israeli invasion of Beirut. When was that? 82, Jim? Is that
82?
As well. Yeah. So it's there isn't a good record. Now, let me pick up on a few things Jim said. I have come up with something I call a Fatah gambit. I probably will write about it next week for my newspaper column. I was on a internet program a couple of days ago and actually chatted a little bit about it. And it is the Fatah substitution for Hamas. Now, I realize I'm putting together a scenario here that is a little story that has many things must happen in order for this to happen, including a political and diplomatic preparation that prepares the ground so that Fatah has some degree of deniability vis-a-vis the Israeli army just for its own domestic consumption about why it takes control over parts of Gaza. Jim has already offered you one of the explanations, which is it's a humanitarian gesture. We need a government with real authority and the government that has the ability to bring in support from Arab governments, meaning the Sunni Arab governments, and the international aid community. And Fatah says there's a vacuum here and we step in. This creates somewhere in Gaza what I would call free Gaza. Call it a small, downscaled West Berlin, ultimately, if you want. And here the long distance analogy is that whatever Hamas still controls, should Hamas still be controlling Gaza, is an equivalent to a degraded, polluted, disastrous, impoverished East Berlin. And the Fatah-controlled portion of Gaza has free open trade with Israel, jobs, and we're back to something of what was in line towards a quote-unquote two-state solution that is based on common economic interests. That is something that the Israelis, I believe, I know they've considered it. I know Fatah considers it. I like the way Jim puts it. What politician could resist that? Again, Fatah has to be in the position of looking like, appearing, that it is coming back on behalf of the Palestinian people. It's also got a political message, two messages that they send when they do this. One is that Hamas showed you they're the classic Islamists. They believe one man, one vote, one time. And then we had our little civil war, and they kicked the elected president out of Gaza, meaning Abbas. The other question they ask, I don't know whether they do it openly or they do it in the streets or whatever, is how many Palestinians must die for the corrupt mullahs in Tehran? Because everyone knows that if Hamas is not quite the ideological puppet, I noticed Jim shied from the term puppet, I'm not ideological puppet of Tehran, because there are some differences. They are the financial puppet of Tehran. And Hezbollah is a wholly owned subsidiary of Iranian intelligence and the mullahocracy in Tehran. However, if we get to talking about the situation in Lebanon, which we might out of our discussion of Gaza, the Hezbollah there, their leader Nasrallah, they're trapped in some tough political binds vis-a-vis the other Lebanese ethnic groups because they really didn't win in 2006. Now, how do you get to this free Gaza? Well, let me backtrack just for a moment. Jim was talking about the phone. You brought up, Dan, the phone calls, and Jim says, well, they've got lists of Hamas operatives, Hamas commanders, Hamas financial operatives, and the Israelis are looking for them. Jim used the term obliteration of Hamas. I agree. I think that is what Israel is ultimately committed to doing, because Hamas is committed to the obliteration obliteration of Israel. And the Israelis aren't going to put up with the rockets, so they're not going to put up with the suicide attacks. They are showing the Israelis that they learned a lot by analyzing those meshed static defense traps that Hezbollah set up for them in southern Lebanon. They integrated, bunkered, all designed to ambush Israeli troops when they moved in. Understand, we know that southern Lebanon has is hilly. Gaza isn't, but the thing is that that's the kind of mesh defense that the Hezbollah made. And also nested in this mesh defense is all the civilian populations, because they're using their own people as human shields. The Israelis said, okay, if we have to fight against this kind of static defense, mesh static defense with human shields, how do we do it? And they came up with, here are two parts of what their military operation is about. One is intense intelligence preparation of the battlefield. Right on down, as Jim pointed out, to phone numbers, to individual rooms in apartments, to know where people live, as well as identification of tunnels, bunkers, weapons caches, laboratories for building equipment and explosive contacts in the bit. That is as large and as difficult an operational intelligence mission as I can conceive of somebody requiring from the intelligence services. But they've done that, and they've done it in Gaza. The second thing is the use of, and Jim pointed out, they've used, you said, I think, Jim, over 1,000 precision munitions so far. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep, around 1,000. Using, among other, besides Hellfires, the new small diameter bomb, which has really the ability to, it's a GPS guided munition, the ability to take out a house without destroying the houses around it. So they're able to wage a very intimate form of warfare with minimizing civilian casualties, making the phone calls and saying, folks, empty your houses. Does several things. One is it does cut down on civilian casualties in a rather jaw-dropping manner. It also is a threat to say, look what we can do, and you can't do anything about it. That's a psychological dimension for the to the phone calls. And the Israelis, after looking at what happened in 2006, this object lesson is one that is not going to be lost on Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. They thought about 2006, and you're watching a military campaign that has learned from 2006.
Now, you mentioned that there was some activity up in southern Lebanon over the last couple of days, right?
Yeah, with a few rockets. I think I'll let Jim talk about that, because
okay.
And pick up on a couple of things I said, though.
Go ahead, Jim.
The action up there has been mostly of Hezbollah alerting its people to make sure any deviants do not go into business for themselves and fire rockets. There have been a few cases where rockets have been found that were set up but had not been launched yet. The Israelis have their counter-battery radars up there, and they will immediately put counter-fire on, you know, the launching sites. So Hezbollah has been but active mainly in making sure nobody does anything. Now, the Lebanese army is also patrolling the area, as well as the UN peacekeepers. But, you know, there's a lot, you know, of area up there that is basically pasturage, not occupied. So especially at night, there's a lot of places where you can sneak around and do things like set up rocket launchers. But that's the only activity that's been going on up there. There have been no preparations for war. And Hezbollah has been basically bending over backwards to assure the majority of the Lebanese population and voters and political parties, who have basically outnumbered them, that they are not preparing any adventures, as it were, you know, south of the border. So if anything, the Israelis would like, you know, Hezbollah to do something so they can pound on them, you know, while there's already a war going on. You know, there's not much added, you know, information war pain, diplomatic pain for the Israelis by pounding Hezbollah as well as Hamas at the same time. But apparently, you know, the Lebanese, you know, Hezbollah is not going to rise to the bait. So it's basically just a death match between the Israelis and Hamas. And again, it'd be very unlikely that the Israelis would withdraw without achieving their goal, because they've certainly tried again and again to cut deals with Hamas. And all the people who are down there, you're urging the Israelis, you know, to come up with a ceasefire deal. They know that too. So a lot of this is being done simply because that's what diplomats are expected to do, to try and, you know, shut down, you know, wars. But nobody down there with half a brain or any active memory cells, would believe that the Israelis are going to, you know, stop this until they've achieved their goal.
Which is, again,
I think the minimal response from this, from a very confined type of response from Lebanon is actually exemplifies something Israelis want to achieve, is to demonstrate how isolated Hamas is, how helpless it is. I mean, Iran has backed them up with bombast. Now they can claim they've started a Lebanese front with the rockets coming down, but as Jim described, it looks like that little flurry of rockets was a demonstration to get a few headlines. It got a few headlines, and it remains to be seen if there is going to be any more attempts to claim that they've opened another front against the Israelis. Hamas is sitting there trapped. It looks like the Egyptians have tacitly agreed with the Israelis to block. Act as a rather large blocking force on the other side of Gaza to keep Hamas pinned in and to keep them from being reinforced through some of those tunnels. So Hamas has got itself in a huge bind right now.
The Palestinians have also got themselves in a pit, as it were. This war is bringing to the surface once more a dirty little secret in the Arab world, and that is that the Arab world made a big mistake in 1949 or 48 during the first Arab-Israeli war, when they told the Palestinians, you know, to leave, that we'll take care of it, we'll get back, you know, we'll destroy Israel. Now it's more than half a century later, and there's been no success. The peace negotiations are still, you know, hung up on the Arab demand for return of all the refugees. And this is the worst sin of all of those Palestinians, or almost the majority, a vast majority, 80-90% of them, were not accepted as, you know, immigrants by the Arab countries they fled to. The Arab countries insisted that they had to remain refugees. That meant they had to remain strangers in these countries where most of them, you know, were born and grew up. There were very few, you know, originals of those people who left in, you know, over, you know, 60 years ago.
Right.
And now the children and grandchildren are saying, well, why can't I be a citizen of Saudi Arabia or Iraq, for that matter? There's thousands of them there still. Lebanon, Syria, Egypt. Indeed, there's a lot of, there's been even Palestinians have been saying, well, why doesn't Gaza just become part of Egypt? Could it be any worse? I mean, everybody knows how Egypt is run, you know, a fake democracy with president for life. But can anything be worse than Hamas?
Right.
And this is bubbling to the surface now. And if you hear it louder, if you hear officials talking about it, you know, let's settle the Palestinian problem the same way the Israelis settled the problem where an equal number of Jews were thrown out of all the Arab countries. I mean, there's no problem with Jewish refugee camps all over the Middle East. Israelis said, hey, come to Israel, we'll make you Israelis. Bingo, end of problem.
Right. Well, now, originally, after 1948, wasn't there supposed to be a Palestinian state established in some of the Jordanian territory?
It was. The West Bank, for a long time, was, even after 1967, up until 67, the West Bank was part of Jordan. And the Palestinians there were Jordanian citizens. For about a decade or so, even when the Israelis were occupying it, the Jordanians continued to claim this is occupied Jordan, But eventually, you know, the King of Jordan, he's a very shrewd guy. He's now deceased, unfortunately, but his son is there doing a pretty good job. He said, all right, I renounce. This happened in the early 70s. Well, I forget the exact date. But anyway, he finally said, I renounce all claims to it. He basically did that after the Palestinians had created their sense of a Palestinian state, which didn't really exist before 1948. And he said, all right, the West Bank can be part of the new Palestinian state. And the Gaza Strip, which was nothing but a big Egyptian, you know, refugee camp occupied by the Israelis, that basically became, you know, the nascent Palestinian state. But it never really took. I mean, the Palestinians could never agree. And that's what's pissed off the Arabs more than anything else. They poured so much effort and money their own, how should I put it, their diplomatic capital, political capital, into this business of a Palestinian state. And the Palestinians have basically been their own worst enemies throughout the whole thing. They almost had a deal in 2000, but the Palestinian radicals, led by Hamas, decided to, no, we're going to start a terror campaign. Maybe we can get better terms. And that backfired big time. That was the second Intifada. And now they're sitting there in their own poop, wondering, well, what the hell do we do now? And the, and their allies, their biggest allies for over half a century, the Arab countries, are saying, well, whatever you do, you're not going to do it with us anymore.
Right, right. Because just of the changes there in the Middle East with, Iran and Iraq and some of the other things.
And the whole business of Islamic terrorism, which began with the Palestinians, not as Islamic terrorism, it began as basically Palestinian terrorism, but now it's turned into Islamic terrorism, and the entire Arab world has basically got fed up with that big time, not just because of 9/11 in Iraq, but for several other Islamic terrorist campaigns in Egypt, in Algeria, in Syria, in Jordan, you know, Black September. They're just sick of it.
Right.
And people are saying, look, you know, let's try something new. It doesn't include Iran, Islamic terrorism, and the idea of a Palestinian state. And the Palestinians don't like this because basically, as the old saying goes, history is leaving them behind.
Well, the Palestinians are being... have the other problem, too.
I was going to say, just as a historical insight on this, King Abdullah of Jordan, what was it, 1950? It was, or is it 51? He's assassinated steps of Al-Aqsa Mosque after prayers with his grandson, who the future King Hussein, who Jim just described, watching because he was ready to make a deal with the Israelis at excellent contacts with the Israeli government, but the radicals wouldn't let him do it, and he was murdered for it.
So, and to this day, the Jordanians have been the most reliable Arab ally or neighbor, so to speak, of the Israelis, even though the majority of Jordanian citizens are Palestinians.
Right. Yeah.
Jordan did accept those Palestinians because up until, you know, up until what, I guess the 80s or the 70s when Hussein basically said, I renounce my claim to the West Bank. But basically the West Bank is part of Jordan, and the Gaza Strip is part of Egypt, has been for thousands of years.
Right. Well, the funny thing to think about is prior to World War I, none of these countries existed. It was all part of the Ottoman Empire. And
yeah, there hasn't been a Palestinian state since, you know, for about, what, over 2,000 years.
Right.
When it was the Philistines.
Yeah.
And they were, and what were they doing back then? They were fighting the Israelis. Don't you get a sense of deja vu with all this?
Right, right. Well, I guess what will happen then, that this will wind down with the Israelis have set some sort of goal of what they want to take out. Once they achieve that, they'll pull back, and then we'll go back to the status quo of negotiating a ceasefire. Yeah. And then it's just a matter of time before another radical group grows up there. Now, isn't one of the problems that the Palestinians have is they have no economic base. They're reliant upon donations from other countries and like that. Or even most of their jobs are across the border inside of Israel, right?
The West Bank is somewhat viable economically, but they lost some 90,000 jobs when they started the Second Intifada. They have since been replaced by foreigners. They've been brought in from all over the world, Southeast Asia, you name it. They're not likely to get those jobs back, or the majority of those jobs are gone. Israelis just don't trust them anymore. The big casualty of the Second Intifada was the left-wing, you know, political parties in Israel that were big supporters, literally, of a two-state solution. But that, you know, with every bomb, every rocket, Qassam rocket that landed, every Israeli that was killed by the suicide bombers inside of Israel, that just evaporated. And most Israelis I've spoken to say it's not going to come back in our lifetime. It's going to take a generation for any goodwill to grow back. And what is growing now is basically the no-state solution. Give West Bank to the Jordanians who don't want it because they've got nothing but problems there with all those Palestinians who have turned radical. And give Gaza to the Egyptians who don't want it because, God, they don't want all those terrorists. The Egyptians, actually, they won't admit it. They are more willing to take Gaza because, A, they have a long, multi-thousand-year historical claim on it. And secondly, they fear Hamas because Hamas has been supporting the Islamic terrorists who are still, the few remaining ones, still active in Egypt. And the reason why the Islamic terrorists have not done well in Egypt is because in the 90s, the Egyptians went full bore after them. And a lot of them ended up in Afghanistan. And in fact, the leadership of those Islamic radicals formed the leadership of Al-Qaeda. They do not want Hamas to provide a base, which Hamas has been doing, for Islamic radicals. And so the Egyptians, you can make the case with the Egyptians, look, how much money do we have to give you? You know, what can we do to sweeten the pot here? You just take the hornet's nest and you deal with it any way you want. And they will, and that's something that'll be ugly. But, you know, they were ugly inside of Egypt and the world, you know, moaned and groaned, but never did anything about it. The Israelis take a lot more heat for taking care of business than the Egyptians do. The big problem, though, is sweetening the pot enough for Jordan to take back. Not to take, but to take back. Yeah, they only renounced it a couple of decades ago. To take back the West Bank and basically be done with it. In other words, that's the true 1967 solution.
Right.
Let's go back to the, you know, everybody talks about 1967 borders. Says, okay, let's do 1967 borders, but with 1967 players.
Right.
No Palestinians. If we're going to go back to the beginning, let's really go back to the beginning.
Right.
And people are starting to whisper about that now. I've gotten emails from people in the Middle East. They say, well, you know, wouldn't we be a lot better off if there was no Palestine whatsoever? And it's Arabs who understand that, you know, gee, if we go back to 1967, there isn't a Palestine.
Yeah. Well, I know
part of Jordan and part of Egypt.
Well, I know personally I'm interested to watch how the Obama administration and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton deal with this, just from morbid fascination of the complexities of it.
Well, you know, they're aware of it. And indeed, they might do a Nixon. In other words, you know, the Republicans might not be able to do this because the leftists will jump all over them. But a leftist, you know, government, Democratic government could do it.
Right.
See that logic? You know, Nixon could go to China, but, you know,
exactly.
A Democratic president couldn't. So, you know, Obama might be able to go to Jordan and Egypt and say, look, let's go back to the 67 borders, you know, with the 67 players.
Right. Well, I think
And there'll still be a Palestinian problem because you still have the issue of the refugees from Israel. But that's
right.
Leave that problem separate.
Right.
Let's deal with the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because that's 90% of it.
Right.
And actually, if you want to settle the other 10%, the Arab states have to do what the Israelis did, accept your own refugees. These are your fellow Arabs. Don't call them refugees. They want to immigrate to Arab. Actually, they'd rather immigrate to North America or Europe. But, and many of them have. But let's face the fact that the refugees in Arab countries, you take them. All right, you can hold up the European country, the West, for more money, you know, for compensation, which is basically going to go into the pockets of the politicians and not the, you know, the people in the refugee camps. That's another issue. But that's what it comes down to. If you want a 1967 solution, you know, do it all the way.
Yes.
And this might become viable with Obama with Obama's government.
Well, I think
I know we're running out of time.
Right.
We are out of time.
I see a two-state solution though as being far more likely. Jim's come up with an interesting scenario, and there are the quote-unquote fed-up quotient, as he's described it. That's very, very real. I think that's part of the reason that you've seen or comparatively muted media attacks on Israel. I know they're there, but it's muted for a lot of reasons. Iranian finagling, but also, you know, what are you finally going to do? But there are some of the two-state solutions based on economic development and economic development, security assurances, and like. I think they're more likely than a return to some sort of 1967 status quo ante. You're not going to have that.
The no state solution.
Anyway, we can leave it at that and pick it up later.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do that in another show.
Yep. We're out of time.
That's right.
We need to wrap it up. So thank you once again, and we'll talk to you next time.
Next week.
All right, take care, guys.
Bye.
Bye.